This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. A hand with extra fingers. Writing that looks like words, but isn't. A smile that somehow you know you've seen before, but on a different face in a stock photo. Many images generated with artificial intelligence still contain these clues that, if you look closely enough, make you ask an increasingly everyday question. Is what I'm looking at real? It's a question that's getting harder and harder to answer, but it's a critical one, especially for people who have dedicated their lives to the simple notion that you can believe what you see and that you should, especially when it comes from credible news sources. David Carson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who has spent the last 25 years with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. For much of the past year, he's been on leave from the paper to study the collision of AI and journalism as a 2025 John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University. David Carson, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited. Been a longtime fan of public radio and a supporter. Miss all my family and friends back there in St. Louis, and I just want to say happy birthday to my wife, who's getting better like a fine wine every year.
Oh, that's lovely. Happy birthday to her. Now, David, how is it that your interest in AI began?
Yeah, so, you know, in 2022 and 2023, chatbots really kind of burst onto the scene, and with that came artificial images, AI-generated images, became publicly available to people with DALL-E and Midjourney. And, they were able to create pictures that looked and felt real. Of course, people could do this for years with Photoshop, but creating high-quality, fakes or images really took a lot of technical skill. And what DALL-E and these AI image generators did was lower the bar to creating images that were believable. People used them to, make superhero pictures of their kids or other things like that. And I think that that's a fine use of it. But I was also became very concerned with the ability that, with this democratization of the AI tools for bad actors to use it to spread disinformation. Mm-hmm. And I think, you look back to 2023, there was a photo of some smoke rising from the Pentagon, and that caused markets to dip. There is a widely shared photo of Pope Francis in a white puffy coat that kind of spread, and that was disinformation. And then there was also photos of Donald Trump being arrested and surrounded and arrested by police that were AI generated and faked. And so all this stuff, all these images go out into the public, and I think it confuses the public, as to what's real and what's not. And we're used to trusting our eyes. And I'm sort of fascinated with us being in this world in this time now where it becomes more difficult to trust what we see.
Mm-hmm. Were there any conversations that you had about any of the images that you just described that made you feel like there was some fundamental line that had been crossed?
I don't remember any specific conversations. I remember just feeling, seeing this stuff and having to sort of look more closely at it. I think, we walk through the world trusting what our eyes show us, because our eyes keep us from, bumping into poles or stepping off of curbs. And so we're inclined to believe our eyes. There's something called the truth default theory, where, we are generally inclined as humans to believe the things we see or hear. And that serves us well, but the problem is that now we're in a world where fakes can be created very easily and very quickly, and very convincing fakes, and in the hands of bad actors, this creates problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, in December, David, you published an essay that included many examples of AI in photojournalism, and that included images that had been posted during the election cycle. But there's one that shows a purported victim of Hurricane Helene. Could you describe that photo for us?
Yeah, so, when I first started seeing this picture come across my Facebook feed, and I was like, oh, that, huh. You look at it and you're like, boy, that doesn't quite look right, but you know, people are really responding to it, and it's being shared very widely. I'm seeing it from multiple friends and family members on their timelines, and them talking about how horrible this is. And this photo is of a little girl, and she has like wet hair, and you can see some raindrops on her, and it's cloudy out. She's clutching a little puppy in a boat, and she's a very teary, sort of emotional look on her face. And it was reported that she, you know, was a victim of the hurricane, and you know, she being rescued, and oh, this poor little girl. And you know, my problem with this is that it was a total and utter fake. This little girl never existed. You know, it was merely a figment of some silicon. She's a pile of synthetic pixels that absorbed all this empathy and sympathy from people. Meanwhile, there were real people having real problems that were being reported on by real journalists. And those stories, those authentic stories, were not getting any attention because everyone was so caught up in this synthetic picture of a little girl that never existed. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that is a problem. We should have empathy. We should feel, we should care about our neighbors and coworkers and family and friends. But, you know, we shouldn't allow our empathy to be spent on these synthetic images like this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there are important stories to be told. It's just that one wasn't one of them. But everyone believed it was, and people were really fired up about it. And I think that's one of the problems.
Do you think that good intention has any place here? I mean, this image was used in a tweet that asks folks to keep victims of Hurricane Helene, you know, in their prayers. So the sentiment isn't necessarily objectionable. You know, the image points to a real event, and it represents actual people and their plight. Do you think that people saying that to themselves is also part of the problem then?
You know, maybe it's just me, but I really want authentic stories of real people and real problems. I don't want imaginary, made-up people in situations. I get the sentiment, but there's also real stories and compelling stories of real people, and I think that should be what we focus on, mm-hmm. right? Not the synthetic, but the real. And I think you're starting to see some backlash against it, where people are beginning to really push back against the idea of synthetic replacing real, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean it's going to stop. We're in a world now where there's just going to be more and more synthetic imagery being produced.
Right.
So, and it's getting better all the time.
David, there's another photo that you have pointed to as an example of how AI can be misused and how, as you argue, it's the result of theft. So this example involves a real photo. It was taken by your colleague at the Post-Dispatch, Robert Cohen, during the 2014 protests in Ferguson. Now, this photo shows a man named Edward Crawford who is wearing an American flag T-shirt as he throws a tear gas canister, and it has really become an iconic image. So, David, you used this photograph to run an experiment of sorts, and you asked AI to recreate this photo from scratch. Can you describe the differences and similarities between these two images?
Yes. So I did this. I did this experiment as part of a class I was taking here at Stanford with computer science professor Cynthia Bailey, and we were running a model evaluation to see if any of my photos or my coworkers' photos had been ingested into the AI training data. And I thought that Robert's photo would be a good example because it is an iconic photograph. You know, probably the best known photograph from the protest. And I began, you know, asking it to see what it would produce. And my first prompt was, you know, can you make me a photo from the 2014 Ferguson protests? And its response was actually very encouraging to me at first. It says, no, I cannot, you know, make a picture which depicts a real scene in a real event. You know, would you like me to make something that was inspired by it? And my second prompt was, yes. And, it, you know, it made a photograph. It, you know, it looked, you know, it had some signs that were reminiscent of it there and of what it was. And it sort of, you know, had the feeling of it. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But within a few more prompts, you know, pretty simple prompts, we ended up at something that I think was pretty clearly a copyright violation. And that was really troubling to me, because I leaned on the model a little bit. I said, you know, can you make a photo of a man throwing a tear gas canister wearing an American flag shirt? And it produced one picture like that that I would say was not a copyright violation. And then I think I asked it to make it a horizontal, and it went immediately to almost an exact copy of what Robert's photo was.
Mm.
And that was a problem. And then I asked it to remove some buildings in the background, and it refined it even more closely to Robert's photo. And so that was from telling me in the first prompt that it could not reproduce a realistic photo from a scene, to, you know, producing the actual a near copy of the photograph that Robert shot. That is the first photograph in our Pulitzer Prize winning entry. So to go from that to that copyright violation in six steps was really troubling to me. And the AI companies are all making an argument that they need the data and the photos for training data to train their models. But I think it's one thing to make an argument that you need it to train your models, and it's a whole nother thing if you're outputting a flat-out copyright violation like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that, you know, it is a problem for not only photographers, but artists and other creatives and writers, that, you know, the way AI companies have ingested and scraped in all this content, you know, they're taking the value. It's very expensive and long and difficult hours have been put into creating these things, and they're scraping the content and then just pumping it out to people who are entering a few quick prompts. There has to be some way to compensate creators for the work they did.
Mm-hmm. Now, legally, there are scenarios, David, where people are permitted to transform copyrighted images or to use those images in the context of education or criticism, and that's called fair use. And you've argued that those categories don't apply to AI images like the one you created. Why is that the case?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There was recently a report that was, I think it was just released Friday by the Library of Congress, where the report raises similar issues about the AI company's use and claims about fair use in generative AI. And this report was critical of those claims of fair use. And there have been judges on the bench. There's a New York Times lawsuit against OpenAI, which runs ChatGPT. And that judge has also been very critical of AI companies' claims of fair use, because it's, if you're looking at what the outputs that the AI companies are producing, it's not fair use, it's copying, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is, and so that's a problem. You know, I think the fair use issue is still gonna, you know, we'll see how this plays out in court. You know, the Trump administration came in and eliminated a lot of the Biden presidential orders on AI and regulation when it started, and put out a call for public comment on future presidential orders here on fair use. I think we're expecting those later here this summer. But many of the AI companies and tech companies filed comments, you know, requesting that they be given a free pass on training data in fair use here. And that to me indicates that they know that they have a problem. There was a lawsuit that was settled between Reuters and an AI company where it came down very affirmatively in favor of Reuters that what this AI company was claiming was fair use was not fair use.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're starting to see the legal precedents begin to stack up against this idea that AI companies have a right to this under the fair use clause.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a quick break here, but we will be back shortly to continue this conversation about artificial intelligence with Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist David Carson and the impacts of artificial intelligence on what we are seeing insofar as images in photojournalism. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Let's return to our conversation with David Carson, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist. He's a 2025 John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University, where he's been on leave from his job at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where he's worked for the past 25 years. David, one of the things that you are getting to experience is being in the classroom with university students. And before the break, we were talking about the AI-generated image that was given to you after you gave all of, what, six prompts? And the result was an image that looked very much like, if not being a copy, of Robert Cohen's photograph of Edward Skeeta Crawford. When you presented about this, these images to some students at the University of Richmond in Virginia, what was their response and what did that tell you about what you've been feeling around AI and photojournalism specifically?
Yeah, so when I first was running the model evaluation at Stanford, I'm sitting in class with all these young students, and you know, it's been really exciting to be in this academic environment again after being out of college for so long. And I'm always very kind of hesitant to show things in class. We're allowed to participate in class, but you know, you don't want to take the experience away from the students. And so I was asked to present my model evaluation first to my smaller section group, and then from the section had a very strong response to it, all the students in there, and they said, well, they wanted me to present it to the entire class there at Stanford. Mm-hmm. Of about 60 people, and it got a really good response there. I then took that model evaluation and I improved upon it by running the experiment again on another ChatGPT image generator, and got almost identical results. And I displayed these results during a talk I gave at University of Richmond, where the room gasped. You know, I showed the photo, I show Robert's original photo, I show the AI-generated photo, and the room goes, oh. And so that tells me that people also think that this is a problem, that they see how that this is theft, mm-hmm. That it's not fair use, that this is theft.
David, do you think that there are any positive use cases for AI in journalism?
I do. You know, I'm not a Luddite. I don't mean to sound like a Luddite and anti-technology mm-hmm. person. I really enjoy technology. I like playing with it and what it can do. I think that, let me find where I was going to talk about this. I think that AI does have a use in journalism. AI is very helpful with crunching large data sets. You can feed large data into this AI and let it look for patterns within it. And then, you know, from there you can see the suggestions and see what AI is connecting. You'd be like, oh, that's a good connection. That's not a good connection. I think the important thing to remember is that AI in journalism, it's really critical to keep human in the loop. We shouldn't just have AI generators knocking out text and pumping that out to the public without it being fact-checked and being, you know, having a human hand in it. AI will hallucinate. It famously will make up facts, and it'll do so in a very convincing manner where it sounds very authoritative. You know, AI is right, you know, about 90% of the time. But the problem with that is that, a 1% fail in journalism, a 1% failure rate in journalism is considered a fail. So mm-hmm. a 90% success rate for AI, you know, is great for the technology companies, but it's not a great journalism solution. People need to be able to trust what they see and what they read. And for that reason, AI is continuing to hallucinate and do weird things. And so we're always going to need to have a human in the loop. I think that journalism should be done by humans for humans, and that, you know, we can use the technology to assist us, right? But I don't think the technology should ever be replacing humans communicating with humans.
Mm-hmm. Has technology like facial recognition or autofocus in camera lenses been at all, you know, helpful to you or maybe to people you know, who want to take photos not necessarily in the journalism realm, but maybe could be used for that later on?
Yeah, so it's really interesting the way, AI can help with things like that. You know, I think you'll see that in your app or in your Apple iPhone camera rolls where, it will group faces, have some facial recognition built into it, and it can group faces and identify faces and help you find individuals within your entire camera roll just by clicking on that one face there, and it'll help you find other photos of that person. You know, in cameras, there's AI built into the autofocus systems where they're helping track subjects moving through there. And, I know that I benefit from, better in autofocus. So the guys who I photograph the Cardinals games were with will tell you that, there's been many times I've missed some photos that they've gotten because, I wasn't using my camera as efficiently as they were. So mm-hmm. I definitely benefit from that autofocus helping my photography. Mm-hmm. But there is danger in AI facial recognition technology. AI, because of its training data set, it does a very good job recognizing pale-skinned white males. But if you get into a darker skinned person or a darker skinned woman, it starts to have a much greater error rate. And so, AI is not a perfect substitute for humans. Mm-hmm. It does hallucinate things. It does make mistakes. I think we need some regulations around how AI is going to be used in our lives and how we're going to integrate it.
I don't think I'm going to be able to get hallucinate out of my mind after having this conversation with you, David. Now, something I want to do is make sure that we do talk about solutions. And something that you have suggested is the use of content credentials. What is that and what change would that make?
Yeah, so content credentials are something that the largest tech companies like Google and Meta and Adobe and camera manufacturers like Canon and Sony and Nikon and all these people and media companies like the New York Times, the BBC, and others in the AP have been working on for about 5-6 years now. And the idea of content credentials is to provide you almost like a nutrition label like you'd see on a piece of food at a store. But this would be like a digital nutrition label, which would allow you to understand where the content you're seeing came from, how it was produced. Mm-hmm. Is it AI? Was it produced with a camera? And it allows you to sign it at different steps along the ways. And I think that this is important to do, that we should give our audience and our readers a chance to see where things came from to help build that trust. Because in a world where people are beginning to doubt the authenticity of what they're seeing, I think that we as news organizations should provide some transparency in how it was produced and who produced it. And I think that's one thing that would be really helpful in the news industry. Mm-hmm. It might take some legislation here. Right now, labeling of content is voluntary. In the EU, in China, in other countries, you're seeing mandatory labeling of AI-generated images. But I think the power of content credentials in the C2PA standard is that it can be applied to both digital synthetic images and real images. And it would be nice to see a world where you would be able to see how your image was produced.
Mm-hmm. David Carson is a 2025 John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University. He's currently on leave from his job at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where he's worked for the past 25 years as a photojournalist. David, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll look forward to seeing you back in St. Louis.
Thank you very much. Look forward to getting home.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.